Hey everyone, I don't trust that step, so I'm going to do from the side. If I haven't met you yet, my name is Vic, and I am one of the leaders here at City Gates. I'll be preaching this morning. We are actually kicking off a series, and believe it or not, there is a video for that, so just play the video. You don't have to fade the lights. After that, I'll start speaking. There you go. Some of those subjects actually flashed up on the screen. If you want to know exactly what we will be covering each week, you can go to citygates.ca/butwhatabout. I think we have a slide with all of those listed on there as well, so let's just have a look at them. Today, obviously, is the question, what about blind faith? And next week, we'll look at Jesus' historicity. We'll look at the Bible's accuracy. Is science done away with the need for faith? What about hell and that doctrine? What about evil and suffering? How do we make sense of that? What about sex? You know, do we have to write that out as well? What about other faiths and other religions? Aren't they valid? And then, of course, the big one, what about hypocrisy? In the name of Jesus and the church, so much is done. Surely that means Christianity is wrong. We'll look at that thing as well. I'm really excited about that, journeying and exploring with many people around those certain subjects. And so if one of those ring true to you, or you can think of somebody that has an objection to faith because of those, I would encourage you to invite them along. We will be journeying together and having conversations about this. But today is about blind faith. What about blind faith? And I want to just lay a foundation a little bit before we get into the details of the subject today. And I want to say that believers, so people like me who consider themselves being a Christian and many here today, doubt for us is a good thing. Actually, if we do not have any doubts, it would be like having a body without antibodies. And if we as believers, as Christ followers, if those believe that there is a God, if we are too busy, if we are too indifferent, if we are too apathetic to actually ask the tough questions about why we believe what we believe, actually we will find ourselves in many ways defenseless against experiences like tragedy, for example, when things go really tough and you don't have an answer for that. Or you find yourself defenseless when others may challenge and attack what we believe. Those that would consider themselves skeptics. Maybe you're here today and you'd say, yeah, that is me. And let me just share you a little bit of my story. I came to faith as a late teen. I consider myself a little bit of an artist, you know, okay? And so I'm more emotional in many ways. And so the message of the gospel really appealed and got a hold of my heart. I was like, wow, God loves me. He gave his life for me, you know, and there's proof in the death of Jesus on the cross 2,000 years ago. And I came to faith because it resonated with what I was like in terms of my wiring. And you know, I grew up in Africa, of course, South Africa, and did a lot of ministry as a Christian and shared this message that I received with many other Africans. Believe it or not, I consider myself one of those as well. And actually, Africans would unashamedly say that they're quite spiritual. And so they were very open to the idea of God because Africans are spiritual people. But you know, I also grew up in a city called Johannesburg, which is like any other metropolis all around the world. Johannesburg, depending on how you count, has anything between, you know, 7 to 15 million people. And it's filled with critical thinkers. And I, because I was growing up in Johannesburg, found myself actually coming against, or people coming against what I believe, challenging me, saying, well, okay, just because it felt right for you and it was a lovely story that gave you goosebumps and a few tears popping out of your eyes, that doesn't necessarily make it true. And so I was faced actually with people trying to poke holes into what I believed, and I had to investigate. I actually had to find myself, it was easy to sort of preach the gospel down in many ways to those that are in desperate need. You know, they're on the bottom, the only way is up. But actually to my peers in my city, I realized that didn't have much to say. And I had to go back to the drawing board and investigate some of these claims and ask the question, yes, you know, was Jesus a real person? Did he actually rise from the dead? Am I illogical in my faith? What about suffering? How do I make sense of that? And so the list just goes on. And so I want to encourage you to wrestle with your doubts as well as Christians, as believers. Two things will happen. Number one, it will equip you in your conversations with those that disagree with us as well. But number two, it will make you respectful of others. It'll actually give you empathy. You will enter into their world and actually see things from their point of view. This is how we ought to live our lives as Christians. And so it's a wonderful gift to us. And so for skeptics, I just want to say this morning, if you're here today, I want to encourage you to also have the self-awareness to acknowledge that you have a faith position in many ways as well. Tim Keller says, all doubts, however skeptical and cynical they may seem, are really a set of alternate beliefs. And to be self-aware enough to admit that actually because you don't agree with us doesn't mean you are void of faith. It's just a different set of beliefs. And so discern these alternate beliefs and understand that underneath each of our doubts, we've got to ask ourselves the question, what reasons have we for believing what we believe? And if we have to be consistent, and I want to say this to skeptics, do not necessarily require more justification from Christians for their belief than you do for your own. That's why we have this journey. That's why we are hanging out together at this stage. And I want to just throw out this warning. We live in an age where it's so easy to get information. Hey, it's so easy to get info. You can get any info, whether it's right or wrong. It's at the touch of a button. It's a quick Google search. It's a quick conversation with Siri. Hey, you can get some information so very quickly. And the problem is it has made us lazy. Because we know we can find the answers, we don't bother getting the answers. And what we do is we align ourselves often with truths that suit our personal preferences. We think, I really like that idea, but we don't bother searching for whether it should be that case or not, because we know that if we one day encounter somebody who pushes back, we can quickly find that information online. And that's also not a very honest way to go about your life in terms of what you believe. And I encounter this all the time as we do these alpha programs, these experiences where we invite people around conversations of faith. So often I hear people say stuff about Jesus that they picked up along the way. And you think, what? And then when you ask them where they get it from, you realize they have never read the historical accounts, the ones you can trust, the biographies of Jesus. They have never picked up reading those. That if you apply the criticism to those texts as would have been applied to any other ancient piece of literature, you can trust those. They never bothered to look. And so I want to encourage you to not fall into that trap. So here's the problem that we all face then, is we have to follow where this evidence leads us, not where we want it to lead us. Because maybe you just have to be honest. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want to be second. I want to be first. I don't want another authority. Just at least be honest about that then. And so as skeptics and believers here today, if we do this journey together, we actually investigate, I believe we will be able to say what we believe with more clarity and with more humility. And I trust that every CityGator here today would learn that skill and we would with humility actually engage with those that disagree with us. And you would find that as you journey with us, that our claim is that Jesus is quite gracious. It's the same way when Thomas, the doubter, said, I will not believe until I put my hands into his holes and into his side. Jesus, when he appeared to him, he didn't rebuke him saying, here I am, you fool, just believe. No, he said, come here, let me meet you where you're at. Put your hands in my side. And you would find that Jesus is quite as gracious as that with us still today, for those of us who have objections. And so the quick big question this morning is it reasonable to believe in God? Is faith blind, or actually do some of us have our eyes open? Isn't religion, and when I say religion, it is as it's defined by secular culture. This is a whole nother sermon, how Christians actually believe we don't have a religion, it's something else. But as defined by secular society, is religion not a matter of faith and secularism a matter of evidence? That's the big question that we throw out there. And we have to start our series with this question, because if God does not exist, then what's the point of us talking about this from here onwards? That is the premise, that is the foundation that we base every other argument on. And the view that religion is a matter of faith, I believe, is a gross oversimplification. I think it's a grave mistake to actually say to believers the burden of proof is on us to prove God's existence. Why do I believe that? Well, traditionally, people have said God's existence must be proved the same way you have to prove that there isn't a Yeti or that there isn't a Loch Ness monster and so on. And I understand that. But remember, those are all fictitious, mythical creatures within the material world. The question about God is whether he's the grounds for the world's existence, so he's outside of the material world. And so I believe that the proof of God, therefore, is not empirical. In other words, it's got to do with a physical object. It's more of a logical inference and forensic in nature. In other words, we're investigating an action or a moment. It's a bit of detective work, like a murder scene, okay? You're not going to recreate the murder. I think we can all agree on that. That's one of the topics I'll be looking at today. No. You're going to look at the evidences surrounding that moment, and actually you're going to come to some conclusions because of what you see around it. And it works the same with scientific theories, especially in physics. It's established this way. They would say theory Y is more reasonable than theory X given the data, explaining the data that we have. That is how we actually argue for the case of God. And I believe that belief in God accounts for the data that we have in a more rational, in a more reasonable way than non-belief does. That's the claim that we are making. Now, varieties of secularisms, as I've said before, are actually sets of beliefs, and I trust that you have the self-awareness to see that. It's not simply the absence of faith. Both systems of thinking must be compared and contrasted in order to determine which make the most sense. That's what we are saying. Will you journey with us? What you believe and what we believe, let's put them next to each other. Let's contrast them and compare them and say which makes the most sense in life. Given suffering, given your experience socially, in the face of all these things, which is the most logically consistent? Which makes the most sense emotionally, culturally, and rationally? I need some more water. A claim is made many years ago that as philosophy and science moves forward, actually belief in God will decline. And it's fascinating. About maybe 30 years ago or so, less than 1% of the professors and the teachers of philosophy were atheists, theists, believing in God. And yet 30 years later, with the advance of technology and discoveries and so on, it's fascinating to see that 25 to 30%, nearly a third to a quarter of people in those faculties actually today believe in God. So this secular myth, we have to bust up front. Actually, it's fascinating to see that the more we discover, the more it makes more rational sense to believe in God. And Anthony Flew, he was one of today's most ardent atheists. He passed away a while ago. He actually retired his belief before his death, full-on atheist. And he stated this, in keeping with his lifelong commitment to go where the evidence leads, this is the challenge we're asking you to do. This is the journey we're asking you to take. Go where the evidence leads you. He now believed in the existence of God, saying this, atheism is no longer a logical position to hold. This is an ardent atheist of our day who changed his view because he followed where the evidence led him to. And so what is that evidence? This is what we're going to be looking at together. I want to call them the clues for God. The clues of God. Philosopher Alvin Plantinga, he's considered to be one of the greatest living philosophers of our day. He calls them clues as well instead of proofs. He said it's easier to make sense of them in terms of the clues because cumulatively, they actually pack quite a good punch. And we are not able to look at all of them. He says there's 2 to 3 dozen of those. I mean, we will just look at a few of them. And in many ways, there will be introductions to those subjects. I would encourage you to read further if you can. And in our small groups, we will give you suggested reading and we'll give you the resources that you need to do that. But we'll just look at a few of them. We'll break them up into 2 big categories. Immanuel Kant said it is the moral law within. And then he said the starry hosts above. The moral law within, the starry hosts above. Anthropology and cosmology, if you want to do it that. Layman's terms, it's people and the universe. Okay, those are the 2 categories that we'll break things up into this morning. And I have to just say that there will obviously be some overlap with our subject on science. That is 3 or 4 weeks away. Doug Hart will be giving that talk. And so although I may give you some of the headlines, Doug actually will add more of those cases to the mix, and he'll obviously give more detail around the ones that I will be mentioning. So look out for that one a couple of weeks from now, the what about science? So the first thing that we look at, the anthropology problem, the stuff within us, is morality. A sense of right and wrong. I think most of us, if we're honest, we can agree that there is this thing built into us, hardwired into us, that we know the difference between right and wrong. I look at my kids. I have 4 of them. The oldest is 12. The youngest is 6. And it doesn't matter what age, what temperament they are. They all kind of share this thing where they would come to mom and dad and demand what is fair based on how others have treated them or they are treating others. Where do they get that from? Where do we get that from? And C.S. Lewis makes this comment. He writes that we all experience these things in our day-to-day work where someone's like, no, that's my orange. Or no, this. He gives these sort of cultural examples of, you know, a couple of decades ago, but it's still true today. Where do we get that from? Whether you're educated or uneducated, we see this common thread across the world that people appeal to a higher standard. That we assume everybody knows. We assume everybody knows what this highest standard is because when we disagree with someone, we make an appeal on the basis of that. And I know in our culture today, we are taught that that moral values are relative. So let's look at that. When we disagree with somebody, we don't necessarily say that we don't like what they're doing. We can often make sense of that. Well, I disagree with you because it's not nice for me. No, that's not how it works. When someone breaks into your house and takes your stuff, we don't say, a robbery is wrong because I don't like it. No, we say we don't like it because robbery is wrong. That's why we dislike it. That is the way that our logic works. And so it's not just that we sense that there's something that we ought to do or something that's right and wrong, but we also sense that there's something we ought to do. It's called moral obligation. We all walk with the sense of that. We have a conscience, and we refrain from doing something if we think it's wrong. We feel we're obliged to withhold that action from life. But it goes deeper than that. Actually, morality exists apart from us in a sense. We feel, regardless of how someone else feels, there are certain principles in life that we hold people to, regardless of how they feel. This moral obligation we find in and all around us. And as I said, moral values today are told to be relative. That actually, it's ultimately about preference, that you just don't really like what they do. But inevitably, we treat people and some principles as absolute standards by which we judge the behavior of those who don't share those values. What gives us the right to do that if all moral beliefs are relative? The answer is nothing gives you that right. But here's the problem. We still do it. We still do it. I mean, if moralism is relative, then you have no right to disagree with someone. But you still do. Why is that? That is the question that we ask. And we see that across history. Recently, we didn't care what the Nazis thought, however sincere they were. You know, they believed that it was right. We believed decisively that this was wrong. It wasn't just impractical for history and for the Israelite nation. It wasn't just distasteful for us and our preferences. We believe it's decisively wrong. That's how we actually live our lives. And so we get all the cultural pushbacks to this. Number one, people would say it's shaped culturally. It depends on the context, where you grew up, and when you grew up. Those are the kinds of things that shape what you believe. And one of my best examples, I would say, is the 60s sexual revolution of how relative moralism, it does not hold any water, is they were obviously saying, hey, listen, do not push your archaic beliefs that my body belongs to someone else. Like, it's my body, I can do with it whatever I like, I can sleep with it whatever I like. And they used to say, make love, not war. That's the problem. Is they were saying, don't put your moralistic view on us to tell us who we can and can't sleep with, but they pushed their moralistic view that you can't go to war with anybody and anybody that you like with onto someone else. Can you see the massive contradiction? Massive contradiction. Who says that if morality is removed, who says that someone cannot kill whomever they want? That's the claim they made to justify their sexual behavior. So it does not hold water. The next one is that we're just a product of our evolutionary thinking. Really? So we, of course, we look at animals. I'm from Africa. I've seen this happen when lions kill zebras or anything else in its way. And we look at that and we don't think, murder, violating a moral code. No, of course not. And you know, as I was doing research, you know, I wanted to see which animals sort of forcibly copulate with another animals, kind of rape. So many, even the cute dolphins do it. We think, oh, they're so intelligent, but they also, but we don't look at that and go, rape. Don't we? So when has it transitioned from, like, if we just, you know, derived from animals, where has it tipped? Why is it different for us if we're just a higher state of an animal that we suddenly believe that forcibly copulating with someone else is called rape, but it's not so for an animal? Or if I just look at you and I think, you look like a fantastic meal, and I start eating you right now, chop your arm off, you know, roast it for Thanksgiving, everybody would say, that is wrong, you cannot eat other people. But we don't do that with animals. Where's it tipped? Where do we get this from? Annie Dillard, She wrote this book called Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and she decided she's going to get in touch with nature. She's going to live on the side of the creek and just, you know, love, you know, become one with where she's come from. And she says some profound things as she stared at nature, realizing, this isn't good. She says, only the human feelings that we have are freakishly amiss in nature. She's like, the problem here is that what we feel does not match up with nature. And she says, like a praying mantis is the worst thing in the world. You know what praying mantis do? After the wife has sex with her husband, she eats his head. And some of you think, that's still happening today. No, of course not. Of course not. She's just like, listen, she came to this conclusion that nature does not condemn these things. So if you want to condemn them, you have to appeal to something above nature to be repulsed by it. Don't be, if you say it's just nature, baby, we got our morals from nature, well, why aren't you repulsed by these things? When you see it happening in nature, but only in us. We appeal to a higher form. We appeal to something outside of nature, clearly, in terms of our morals. We believe, that preserving your tribe is normal in nature. That's kind of how we got to where we are. It was advantageous for our species. But that's not why people in South Africa, for example, protested against racism, saying, "Oh, this is not advantageous for our growth." No, they said it's decisively wrong. Apartheid must be abolished. That's my history. I know there's a bit of that history out here on this continent in this country. But you see, we appeal on the basis of things being right and wrong, not necessarily whether they are advantageous for our species. That's not how we reason through right and wrong. We don't use those arguments in daily life. And you have to take this idea all the way, friends, if this is what you believe. Darwin obviously wrote this popular book, The Origin of Species. He talks about natural selection. There's the other half of his book title that no one likes to quote. It goes like this. It says, The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. No one really likes to quote that half of his book title. Because when we read that, we go, ooh, that doesn't sound right. Preservation of certain races in the struggle of life, choosing one group of people over another. And in that book, he talks about not allowing the mentally challenged to marry and to hinder mankind's progress. When you hear that, you think, dude, that doesn't sound good, right? You have to be honest. That you have to take your worldview to its intended sociological implications. No ways. His theory was, if we do it with horses, why don't we do it with humans? Hey, the perfect breed. Hey, listen. Let's do it with us. So actually, if you're mentally challenged, please don't marry. Let's not hinder mankind's progress. J.B.S. Haldane, he was a British scientist. He contended for eugenics. Now, eugenics is just a fancy word for controlled breeding, deciding who gets to sleep with who. Evolutionary thinking fueled this kind of thinking. I came to realize that many conventions were held back in the wake of World War II when people thought about this stuff. It's crazy. And Bertrand Russell, who some of you may know, he actually followed in Haldane's footsteps and he advocated for the sterilization of the mentally deficient. He said, let's just take it away from them, the ability to procreate. This is evolutionary thinking that fueled this. Listen, we all know who took it to the max. Adolf Hitler. In his book, Mein Kampf, he took Darwinianism to its natural conclusion. He wrote this about Mother Nature. He said that, listen, if we get in the way of Mother Nature, you know, if we don't allow inferior species to be dominated by a superior one, in other words, stop the intermingling of superior races with inferior races, he's like, we're undoing the work of Mother Nature over hundreds and thousands of years, and we render it pointless. And he ends up by saying, if you don't wish to fight in this world, you have no right to exist. He cuts across human rights. It's such a big thing today, but this is what you do when you take that naturalistic viewpoint, that Darwinianism, evolutionary thinking, to the max. That's where you will end up. Why do we not accept this? Why are we appalled and repelled by this? Because we believe, as Christ followers, we believe as Christians, that actually this is something God put into mankind. And if you just think about this theory that we are just a product of naturalism, it is counterintuitive what we see today, because this is the claim. The claim is that altruistic people, that is a fancy word for people that are selfless, people that consider others over themselves. It says that they survived in greater numbers than those who were selfish and cruel. And that's why today we feel that being unselfish is a right behavior. That's why we think it's a product of our evolutionary thinking. Yet, we know also that for evolutionary purposes, we have to say that the opposite response is just as good. That's why we're here today, that we should, you know, be hostile to others outside of our group to preserve ourselves. And that should just as widely be considered as moral and right behavior. So you cannot hold these two together. If you say, yeah, you know, altruistic people survive because the tribe survived, well, in the same way you have to say, well, and if you look down upon another tribe so that your tribe could survive, that's also the right thing to do. And most of us would say, no, racism is wrong. It's not right. And actually, that kind of altruism, Tim Keller argues, means that those kinds of people would have died out long, long ago. The people who chose to be dead instead of someone else. I'll die in your place. It means that actually those kind people would die out. They would filter out ultimately. They wouldn't be around for their genetic code to be passed on. And here's another argument that they would say, well, if you are altruistic, kind towards someone else, of course it stirs up the benefits of reciprocation. I'm nice to Brian. Brian's nice to me. That's how it works. Tit for tat. But it doesn't make any sense if you think about it. Because what is the purpose then to be good to somebody without them even noticing? Because that's even a higher virtue. When I'm nice to Brian and Brian does not know I'm nice to him, what is in it for me? He doesn't know. He's not going to go, oh, I owe you one. And yet that is a virtue. We consider that to be more right. It doesn't make sense. What is the point of being altruistic if no one knows you are? How can there be reciprocal benefits? And so actually that argument, I feel, falls apart on so many levels. What's the conclusion? Well, Darwin claims that we don't need God to be good. Actually, I've got someone who follows me on Twitter. It says, good without God. This is quite a movement today. And it's fascinating because he did this, he based it on the study someone else did where they took a whole bunch of people, religious, non-religious, people of faith, non-people of faith, and they gave them some moral options in front of them. And they all chose the good thing, to do good instead of bad. And so the theory was, there you go. See, you don't need God to be good. But we would say that is exactly proof for what we're trying to say. Is that decision between right and wrong and the knowledge of what's right and wrong is stitched into us. It's built, it's there already, regardless of whether your position of faith. And actually, it points to somebody putting it over there. I'm going to read one scripture just to show you that this is our Christian worldview, our philosophy. Romans chapter 2, verse 14 and 15. It will be up on the screens. It says this, for when Gentiles, those were non-Jews at that stage, who do not have the law, the Jews had the Ten Commandments, do this, don't do that, etc. By nature, do what the law requires. They are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts. Next one. While their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. This is one of C.S. Lewis's arguments for morality. He says it's the excuses we make when we don't do right. We say, I was rude to my children because I was tired. He says, a long list of excuses. It actually shows us we don't make excuses for being good. We only make excuses for being bad because we feel like there is a judge. There's somehow some higher standard that we need to appease. We make excuses. This is what the Christian worldview says. It's written on our hearts. And it implies, therefore, that there is a writer. There is a writer. I know cultures and contexts may disagree on the details of that, but that doesn't disprove that there is a moral code, a higher code that God put in us. Just like if you come up with the wrong math answer, you don't disapprove or disprove the mathematic timetable. No, you just arrived at the wrong answer. It doesn't undo the whole system. And so we understand some people miss it here and there, but that doesn't mean that the equation is wrong. And I would just say, if you insist on a secular view of the world and you still continue to pronounce some things right and wrong, you have to see the deep disharmony in your statement. If the premise, your premise, that there is no God leads you to conclusion that you don't think is true, in other words, you know, napalming babies is just morally relative or culturally relative, then you have to change your premise. If what you believe there is no God leads you to a conclusion that you disagree with, you can't hold on to the premise anymore. That is our encouragement to you.
Here's another one. So we looked at morality, right and wrong. Another one is consciousness. I'm not going to spend too much time here, but it's the appreciation of art, music, and love. Evolutionary thinking tells us that it is just an illusion as looking at that we inherited this kind of stuff from our ancestors, because when we looked at the hills and we thought, oh, that's a beautiful view, all that we really said was, there's lots of food here, and so I'm going to live over here. You know, it's a natural instinct to think it's beautiful because there's food there. That's how we do this equation. Our chemicals in our brains make sense of those things. But yet, in the presence of great beauty, you know that you feel that there is somehow meaning in life. Hey, when you look at an amazing piece of art, when you listen to an amazing bit of music, you feel like, man, life matters, love matters, there's purpose, there's reason. You know you go through those things. And this is what's so amazing. Humans are the only ones with this thing called consciousness, that we are self-aware. We wonder about our place in the universe. Your little puppy that you take for a walk every day does not think about its place in the universe. It does not think like it. Horses do not think like that. But humans do. There's this void that we constantly try to fill. And the objection to that is people saying, oh, just because you feel it doesn't make it true. And I understand. That's actually a pretty good argument. But I would say it's not just a feeling. It's an appetite. It is not a preference here. There is this appetite that you have. You're not going to say a hunger is a feeling, it's an illusion. You will be dead in 3 weeks, people. It is an appetite that you have. And doesn't the appetite for food in us actually mean that food actually exists? Hey, isn't that how it works? It corresponds to real objects, much like when you're tired, you know sleep is a real thing, and so you have to go sleep. Mike Holmes, not while I'm preaching. I'm joking. That was a total joke, people. He was riveted. I mean, I'm going to get riveted afterwards by him. We have a longing, a joy, a love for beauty that no amount of food and sex and friendship and success can actually satisfy. We want something that nothing in this world can fulfill. Isn't that a clue that the something that we want exists? Think about it. As one philosopher said, because we have the longing that nothing in this world can satisfy, it's proof that we were made for another world. And when Dawkins was asked this question, can you explain to us why humans have this sense of consciousness, self-awareness? You know what his answer was? I don't know. He admitted, I don't know. He says, but one day computers will figure it out. Now, friends, that is a faith statement. If you're here today as a skeptic and you say, no, I'm at the absence of faith and belief, you have a set of beliefs, just like Dawkins had when he said that. One day, computers will figure it out. It hasn't figured it out yet. It's a faith statement. So don't tell us we're illogical and without faith. I would push back a little. That we are with faith, you are also holding a faith position. So the question is, what's the most rational thing to believe? In all the marketplace of ideas, what makes the most sense? You know, the Bible tells us that we were made in God's image. Here's another scripture for you. Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. It tells us that the Lord formed man out of the dust from the ground. It can mean so many things. We don't have to get into those details. The mechanism, as long as we know that there's an agent, his name's God, and he breathed into the nostrils the breath of life. This is where this consciousness comes from, the meaning of life, the pursuit of those things, and man became a living creature. This is what sets us apart from the animals. This is what we believe. This is why we have morals. So that's internal. That's anthropology. I want us to move on to cosmology a little bit. And honestly, I have to just touch on these aspects because I know Doug will do a great job when he preaches on science and faith. In cosmology, this is agreed upon by scientists and philosophers, both atheists and theists alike. They all agree on this thing called causality, that everything that begins to exist has to have a cause, or have to have a cause, right? Cause everybody agrees with that. And so then that begs the question, well, what existed before that? What has no cause? What has always been existed? What has always existed? And so the answer for many years was that, you know, it was God. But in our sort of modern secular context today, they've threw away that. And eventually said, no, we don't need God. The universe is the thing that has always existed. The universe is the thing that has always been there, and so that was our answer until 1929, when Hubble pointed his telescope and actually made the discovery that the universe had a beginning. It actually came into being. What? This is crazy, you know, and you want to tell me that Genesis 1 verse 1, we'll look at it in a moment, is an actual thing? Yes. In Genesis 1:1, the scripture will be up on the screen. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There you have it. In the beginning, God, he was already there. When he created and he started the universe, he was already there. The thing of causality. How can something come from nothing? No, nobody settles for that. More about that in a moment. And then there's the second law of thermodynamics. Okay? This basically tells us that there's a limited amount of energy in the universe. It's like a flashlight with batteries. It's running out. It's going to die eventually. If the universe was always there, based on the amount of energy that there is, the theory is it would have already run out of energy. It would have already burned up. It would have been gone. And so actually the universe, it was not the thing that has always existed. And this was the pushback. Actually the scientists pushed back against this theory initially, this thing of first cause, because it sounded very much like Genesis 1 verse 1. They were like, no, we are giving a divine foot. We're putting a divine foot in the door. They pushed back against that. It was one of Einstein's biggest regrets, is he held on to the steady state theory that, you know, it's always been, and actually did not agree with Hubble until he went to his place and he looked through the telescopes, he looked at his equations and changed his mind. That was his biggest regret, because actually scientists did not want to agree to this, because it somehow seemed like you were giving into the Judeo-Christian idea that God began it all. So then the question is, people would say, well, who created God? And I want to say, really? You don't have the right to ask that question. You can't ask that question without answering the first question. You can't just skip the first answer and now say, oh, who created God? Don't ignore the elephant in the room. God created everything. Don't say, oh, who created him? Modern theory is that aliens created and other intelligent beings. It all comes down to the fact that actually the universe isn't the thing that was uncaused. Something caused it. You can bring it back to a point in time, 15 or so billion years ago. Everything that we know, matter, space, and time, came into being. And we have a worldview that supports that. There's the nothing hypothesis, where they say nothing times nobody equals everything. Okay, you want to hear that again? I'll flip it around. Nobody times nothing equals everything. And everybody here goes, that doesn't sound right. Can you write that down for me? Okay, when your wife or your girlfriend, all right, or your sister, she looks a little upset and you go up to her and you go, hey, what's wrong? And she says to you, nothing. Okay, we all know nothing isn't wrong. We all know that that's not a valid answer, okay? It is only stupid men who go, oh, okay, nothing's wrong, and they carry on with their lives. It is actually kissing your brains goodbye to accept the theory that there's nothing wrong. Okay, nothing doesn't cause something. If her lip is on the floor and she's crying, it's not nothing. It's something. It's not nothing. I'm so sorry. She's crying out there as well. Last night I went to bed. Everybody else was already sleeping, put all the lights off. I put the door on the latch, and I lay down. And in that moment, the door came off its latch and it opened up and light streamed into the room and went, and my heart started pounding and I was like, what is going on here? Well, who is here? I couldn't say, it's nothing. I couldn't say that. I didn't want to settle for the theory that the door just opened by itself. No, something happened. I know what happened ultimately as I sat there and did all my mathematical equations. I realized it was my pillow that I had taken off. I threw it on the floor. It created a draft of wind that swept in under the door, knocked it off its latch, and slowly it opened up and freaked me out. Okay? That is the scientific explanation of what happened. It wasn't nothing. In our street at the waypoint, every now and then, a car alarm just keeps going off incessantly. It just keeps happening. And the person switches it off and comes back, switches it off. It's like it just goes off by itself. Nothing is doing that. That's just something that a neighbor would say to keep his angry neighbors off of his back. It's not a valid explanation for why his car alarm keeps going off. Something is causing it, and we'd like for him to get to the bottom of it. Nothing isn't good enough. And yet we settle for that theory in terms of everything you see around you. Hey, It's not a logical, reasonable way to look at it. And then people would come up with theories like the multiverse, and they would say, well, actually, there's so many universes out there to make sense of it. I know just our one came into being, and that might be chance, but there's multiple universes, which gives the probability of ours coming into to being by itself more probability. But that has never, ever been proven, that there's a multiverse. They say it's kind of like bubbles and foam, you know, as there's lots of bubbles connected, some pop and some grow and so on. There's not a shred of evidence for that. That is what people who do not want to believe in God say. And Alvin Plantinga, he's got some great illustrations, and I'm pretty sure Doug will cover those about showing how absurd that is. Another thing I want to look at is design. And again, I want to just break it up into two categories. I'm almost done. Are you guys still with me? Having fun? Fantastic. Is biology and astronomy, the microscope and the telescope, again, if I can put it that way, the small and the big. We look at DNA and the complex data that we see in there. It screams there is a mind behind it. You know, when Darwin was doing all of his experiments, he was working with, you know, wings and fossils and feathers and those things. Today, we are dealing with complicated data that is in DNA, stuff that he did not have. And we look at that, we go, there must be a mind behind this. Must be. When you look at a riverbed and you see a little stone with water going over that, you go, that is nature. You look at the Grand Canyon, you think that is nature. But when you find a little arrowhead in there, you go, this can't be nature. That seems like this is designed, it's purposeful. This. Somebody must have made that. Or when you look at Mount Rushmore, you don't go, just give it time and a president's face will just pop out of the mountain. No, you think there's mind behind that. And it's so when we look at the pyramids, you think there's mind behind it. Of course, yet. And this is what science is telling us, that a single cell organism like an amoeba contains enough data to fill 30 encyclopedias. That's why Francis Collins, I have this book, it's an amazing resource. It's called The Language of God. As he headed up the team that decoded the human genome, he looked at DNA. His conclusion was, there's a mind. This stuff is too complex. It's too complex. You don't just give it time and all this data will form itself. No, when you give complexity time, it becomes more random, not less random and structured. So that's the DNA. Then there are the dials in the universe, these 122 constants that had to be in place, the speed of light, the gravitational constant, the strength of the nuclear forces, all of these aspects, these constants that had to be precisely aligned for us to be in existence. You know, the Goldilocks theory that the porridge was just the right temperature, hey? The bed was just as soft as it ought to be for her to find somewhere to settle. That is our story. The universe had these Goldilocks circumstances. It's called the anthropic principle, that the universe was prepared for human beings, it seems. Just for us. The vastness of it, all just for us. Like a cosmic welcome mat, one philosopher said. And Stephen Hawking, considered to be the greatest scientist ever, you know, he writes this about the odds of the universe coming together, all those dials being aligned precisely, sometimes to the million millionth. And he says, the odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think there are religious implications. Hawkins is not willing to accept chance and nothing as an explanation, and neither should you. It's a non-explanation. It does not make so much sense. Then there's the question of where did the laws of physics come into play anyway. Those dials and the process, those things existed already before. They didn't come into being in that moment. They were already constants. They were already things that needed to be in place. Where did that come from? And the pushback that we get when Darwin was asked this theory, where did the laws of physics actually come from? You know, he said, well, physics does not yet have its Darwin, when Dawkins was asked. But again, technology will figure it out. Another faith statement. Another faith statement. That's a set of beliefs, no proof for it, just hoping, one day technology will figure it out. And maybe you're turning and say, what if I don't believe? What if I don't want to believe is the best question, statement that you may make. Well, where does the evidence lead you, I want to ask? Rejecting the evidence. I know, car alarm, it's amazing. These illustrations are divine in one sense. I feel like God is here. He's got my back. (Laughs) Rejecting the evidence, some of what, not all, some of what we have spoken through this morning of God, I think creates more problems than they create solutions to problems. And so what are your options? What are your options actually in front of you? Be honest about those things. Christianity says that if you follow the evidence, you find God, you get to God. But I see that people would rather believe in an infinite amount of unproved universes than one that we actually see we can prove, that we have enough data and clues for to make sense of the data. People would rather choose to believe in a fairy tale of unproved universes and multiverses than that. That takes faith, I believe, on a whole new level. And so be honest. You can't just say, oh, well, lucky us. Lucky us. I don't think that's a valid answer. And I want to say maybe you have to doubt your doubts, and perhaps we are not the ones that are blind in our faith. Let me pray for you. Lord, I thank you this morning that we could look at these concerns, these objections. We can look at them logically. We thank you that you've given us the gift of reason to be able to determine right from wrong, and this consciousness that we've received, all of these that are clues to you. And I pray that we will actually use these faculties that we have and explore. If we disagree with them based on our preference, that we would be self-aware enough to admit that. And I pray that you take us on a journey. This is just one of 9 weeks, and I pray that we grow in knowledge, that you'd equip us as Christians even to be more kind and humble in our approach to these things, and that we would also be more informed when we do discuss these elements with those that would deny your existence. I pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Amen. Well, it's been great hanging out. There's some coffee afterwards. And if you're a visitor here today, please don't rush off. Tell us that you are here. Tell us what your experience was like. You can either do that in person, or obviously, if you fill out on our website, you can be as inconspicuous as you like. But yeah, we're going to have some coffee right now. Don't go home. And those that are packing up downstairs, enjoy. God bless.